We know that pledge breaks are your least favorite part of listening to NHPR. So we've been trying really hard to eliminate them this month. If we manage it, if you help us manage it, we can eliminate those pledge breaks this month. But we need your help now to make it happen. More of your favorite programs, fewer interruptions when you make a gift now at nhpr.org.
The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. In the 1998 film, The Truman Show, Jim Carrey plays a man who becomes aware that his entire life has been the subject of a reality TV show broadcast 24/7 to people around the world.
Why don't you let me fix you some of this new Mococo drink? All natural cocoa beans from the upper slopes of Mount Nicaragua, no artificial sweeteners.
What the hell are you talking about? Who are you talking to? Tell me what's happening!
Well, you're having a nervous breakdown. That's what's happening.
You're part of this, aren't you?
A few years after the film, psychiatrist Joel Gold began to notice an increasing number of patients convinced that their lives were being similarly filmed and broadcast. He called it the Truman Show delusion and began to explore its particular character with his brother Ian, a neurophilosopher at McGill University. At a time when mental illness is increasingly viewed through the lens of neuroscience and genetics and treated with pharmaceuticals, the Gold brothers explore connections between the development of psychosis and schizophrenia and changes in culture and social life, from bullying to immigration to urban living. It's a new approach to considering the interaction between the brain and the world around us, and it's covered in a book called Suspicious Minds: How Culture Shapes Madness. Virginia spoke to Joel when the book was first published. It's now available in paperback.
Joel Gold, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Now tell us about that very first patient, Albert. This was back in October of 2003. You describe him as your first Truman Show patient.
Yeah, it was Halloween. I remember pretty clearly a Friday. He was admitted to my unit, and he described his life just as you described it. His life was a reality show. In fact, he mentioned the Truman Show. He said, "My life is like the Truman Show." At the time, I didn't make too much of it. It was fascinating. He had come to New York from out of state. His idea was that if he had come and found that the Twin Towers were still standing, he would know that even the attacks of 9/11 were essentially a put-on for him just to get a reaction for the show. But if they were, in fact, destroyed, he would acknowledge that perhaps he was delusional, which is actually somewhat unusual for people to have that insight that they might be ill. When he came to New York, unfortunately for him, he didn't get to the World Trade Center. He got as far as the United Nations, and at that point he decided to seek asylum from the show by going to the UN. A scuffle ensued, and he was brought to Bellevue. Again, I didn't make too much of it, as we see so many fascinating delusions at Bellevue. But over the course of time, I saw more and more of these patients and started connecting the dots.
More and more people saying, you know, my father is an actor paid to play my father. The people around me are actors. But is this delusion just a new name for an old delusion? Would it have been called something different in the 1950s or 60s?
Absolutely. We looked into this over the course of the writing of the book, and initially we weren't really sure if this was something new or something that had existed. There's a form and content question, and we discovered that over the course of time, there were only a handful, maybe a dozen forms of delusion: paranoid or persecutory, grandiose, religious, etc. And many people believed, and we came to believe, that over the course of time, as culture changes, so too do the delusions, the content changes. So in the backdrop of the Cold War, for instance, people might have thought that the KGB were after them, or that the CIA had implanted a microchip in their tooth. As we now live in a society of reality television and surveillance, that has now come to fill in the blanks, so to speak, of these kinds of delusions. And initially, we had the thought that it was more of a persecutory and grandiose delusion. As time passed, we came to think of it as more of a delusion of control, wherein people feel like they're not really in control of their own lives.
Now, we see these kind of cycles of belief, of where madness is coming from. Is it spirit? Is it the brain structure? Is it environmental factors? How does this history and those cycles inform your theory?
That's a wonderful question, and absolutely, over the course of time, things have changed. We often think of psychiatry as having started with Sigmund Freud and psychoanalysis and psychotherapy, and then the advent of psychotropic medications in the 60s, 70s, and beyond. But in fact, before that, in ancient times and really up until Freud, it was very much like it is today, very much a biological approach. Something is wrong with the brain, and people would, you know, bore holes in skulls and, you know, the kind of bleeding with leeches approach, that there was something wrong with the humors. Now we've returned clearly with a vengeance to the biological model, and I'm not at all opposed. I worked at Bellevue, and I was very comfortable prescribing antipsychotic medication to my patients who were suffering from delusions and hallucinations. But I believe that the pendulum has swung too far in the direction of the biological, both in terms of the cause of psychosis and the treatment. So I think that it's very important not just to look at the biological underpinnings, but the environmental contributors to one developing psychosis, schizophrenia, for instance, and that you can actually do talk therapy of a kind with psychotic individuals and get results. And it's not simply reaching for the prescription pad.
So let's get into that theory. Your theory is that we need to look beyond neurology or genetics to consider psychosis and schizophrenia to cultural or cognitive factors. And this leads to your research into evolutionary psychology, and you come up with this hypothesis about the suspicion system that gives the book its title. So what is the suspicion system? What is its function?
Well, we believe that there's a part of the brain, and we have no particular sense of what the anatomy is, though we might guess at it. But this function is something that evolutionarily has developed in order to act as a kind of an alarm that will detect danger in the environment, particularly social danger. But when that system goes awry, instead of being able to question those initial thoughts, like someone's walking in the forest, if you hear that crack, you quickly turn around. Mm-hmm. Is it an animal that's chasing after me? And you think, no, it's just the wind. That's what we call the reflective system, the slower ability to reflect on that initial impulse. But if that initial impulse doesn't shut down, it becomes hypertrophy to the point where it really is now a delusion that's very firmly held.
So the system that we as human beings have to fear the Bengal tiger, I guess, in the woods,
right,
suddenly factors in our whole place inside of a social structure.
Yeah. In times long ago, people lived in, you know, villages, small towns, and there's some research that suggests that our brain is only able to really fit about 125 or 150 people in there. And what I mean by that is, if you live in a small town with about 100, 150 people, you pretty much know most of the people in it, if not all of them. And so you can feel a little bit more comfortable. But as cities grow in number, there are more unknown others. And when there are unknown others, there's a sense that they may mean to do us harm. And so this system becomes more important in a sense. And there is evidence that the larger the city one lives in, the greater the incidence of psychosis and schizophrenia. It's actually well established, much like living in a large city might put one at higher risk for lung cancer because the air is not as clean. People don't really know about this, including psychiatrists and psychiatric researchers, that certain environmental factors such as living in an urban environment, being an immigrant, or being a survivor of child abuse makes one higher risk for developing psychosis later in life. And these are, again, environmental factors, much like smoking cigarettes is for lung cancer and heart disease.
What is the role of culture in influencing delusions, psychoses, or schizophrenia? Joel Gold and his brother Ian have been researching that very topic and the incidence of something they call the Truman Show delusion. It's covered in a new book called Suspicious Minds: How Culture Shapes Madness. You're looking at delusions as a malfunctioning response to a social environment, right?
Absolutely.
What is the relationship to that and the Truman Show delusion? What purpose does that serve?
If things feel not quite right, one has to be on their guard. Again, like the Bengal tiger you referenced, if there are all of these people and they seem a bit strange, I don't know, they're looking at me, they're making signs, maybe there's something going on here. And then perhaps you see or remember the movie, it inflames the suspicion system, so to speak. And instead of, oh, I don't know, maybe I'm just having a strange day, I didn't get a good night's sleep. If someone has, again, these risk factors, suddenly they may be using the Truman Show effect to act as a kind of scaffolding for their feelings. But if we become so much on guard that we're not able to step out of it, we have these persecutory ideas. And then for, again, a number of these younger people, late teens, early 20s, who may be inching into psychosis, the Truman Show might resonate with them in a sense. And they say, yes, this is my life. And it's very hard to move them out of that.
Joel, very early in the book, you say that you are seeking some balance in the conversation about the role that genetics and neurobiology play as compared to experience, culture, society, environment. But I know in my life and probably the lives of many others, there are people close to us with mental illness, and in many ways, acknowledging the role of biology and genetics destigmatizes, depersonalizes, takes away this sense of fault or shame. So what's the balance in that conversation?
Oh, I think that's such an important point. For many years, particularly during the height of psychoanalytic theory, there was the notion of the schizophrenogenic mother, the cold, uncaring, aggressive mother who would actually induce schizophrenia in their child. And for many years, this was obviously not true and very, very painful for families who were either enraged because they knew it wasn't the case, that they were loving parents, loving siblings, or intense guilt. What did I do? Maybe I should have done this or that and my child would be well. So in that regard, the biolization of psychosis and schizophrenia was a wonderful thing for those patients and their families. At the same time, it would be irresponsible of us to recognize that there are environmental factors. Most families of schizophrenic patients have loving, wonderful families, but that's not to say that there aren't, unfortunately, some kids who are severely abused, and those kids who are abused are at higher risk. So we're not painting everyone with a broad brush, but that's just the fact. But we want to make it clear we're not suggesting that because we want to look at the environment and culture that we're pointing fingers at family members. If someone lives in an urban environment and therefore, you know, including myself, you're in New Hampshire, I'm in New York, and in that sense, I'm at higher risk for developing schizophrenia than you are, one could say, well, am I being unfair to my kids by choosing to live in a large city? Perhaps I should move to, you know, a bucolic town and lower their risk. But most of us don't do that. And so we have to live in the world in which we do. And I think this is something that very, very challenging for families and for patients.
Joel Gold, thank you so much for joining us.
Great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Joel Gold and his brother Ian have together written a book called Suspicious Minds: How Culture Shapes Madness. There's much more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org.
We're caught in a trap. I can't walk out because I love it too much, baby.
In 2014, the American Heart Association released a report indicating that adults who watch TV for 3 or more hours each day are twice as likely to die at a younger age. As alarming as that headline may be for the average viewer, imagine if it were your job to watch hours and hours of television every day. After the report, New York Times TV critic Neil Genslinger said he was turning his back on the confusing world of research on TV habits, and you should too. He spoke with Virginia Prescott.
Okay, so a report begins. A new study finds that watching TV could... dot, dot, dot. What's your first thought? Run in the other direction?
That is pretty much my first thought, especially with this new study, which essentially said watching TV will kill you. That's particularly alarming to read that for someone who watches TV for a living.
Well, you got to understand the impulse. I mean, we'd like to know how something as habitual as TV is affecting our lives, right?
It's true. My personal feeling is that television has kind of entered the phase that some other things are already in, things like food. I haven't eaten in years because I can't keep track of which foods are good for you this week and which foods are not good for you. So the only thing to do is just to stop eating. It seems like there's a new study every week or every couple of weeks on their effects, and they're so ingrained in our lives anyway that it's not as if they're going to disappear. So you can either spend your whole life trying to keep track of these studies, or you can just try to use common sense, which is what I've decided to go with from now on.
Well, I've always wondered how TV critics find time to see so many programs. So what do you guess on average? How much television do you watch for your job?
How much do I personally watch?
Yes.
So 5 hours a day anyway.
So should I just clarify, you're not overweight, have diabetes, or a teen mom?
I am none of those things. I weigh 148 pounds, and when I'm not watching TV, I run half marathons. So that's my version of common sense. I watch a lot of TV, but I try to actually get some exercise when I'm not watching TV, and that's really what this new study is telling people. You can't sit on the couch all day, every day, and expect to be healthy, and you shouldn't need a study to tell you that.
Okay, I know you said you'd like to steer clear of these, but I wonder if I could get your take on some of the TV-based research headlines from the past couple of years. Can we go through some of those?
Sure.
Okay, TV, a sleep detriment in children study finds. Any thoughts?
I have a couple of children, and sometimes they didn't sleep well. I'm not sure how that study pinned that on television as opposed to on a million other things that could be going on in a child's head. Kids are complicated machines, and it's hard to imagine that a single thing like television is responsible for everything that's wrong with them or everything that's right with them. That's the thing about these studies. They sometimes contradict one another. You can find a study that says television makes kids stupider, but you can also find a study that says television makes kids smarter.
Okay, how about TV in the bedroom equals better sex, study finds?
I'm not sure I've seen that one, but I'd like to. I suppose it could be possible. Depends on the couple, I would think. And
I'm guessing the viewing as well.
Yes, and what they're watching. Johnny Carson, of course, used to make that. That was a running joke, you know, about children that had been conceived because he was boring people too much and they decided to stop watching, that kind of stuff.
So, Neil, what if you were a researcher looking at the effects of television on people's lives? What would you study?
I am more interested in the positive effects of television, and not because I'm trying to boost television, but I particularly think of my mother, who is 94 years old, still gets around, but not that much, watches some fair amount of TV to keep engaged. She'll want to talk about whatever the latest show is. For people like that, television is, is a good thing. I think it's a lifeline. It's a way to stay connected, and broadening the cultural horizons of people is an important function for television. I think 100 years ago, you lived in your little town or whatever, and you really didn't know a lot about what other people, other races, other religions thought or felt. Film, radio, and certainly now television has broken down a lot of those barriers. Some people might think that's a negative. I don't. I think it's a positive. I think exposure to the world is a positive thing.
Neil Genslinger is TV critic for the New York Times. He also reviews film and theater on occasion. You'll find a link to his article, Why the Research on Viewing is Best Ignored, along with a list of our favorite contradictory television studies at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. As a kid, you probably played Exquisite Corpse. Just to refresh your memory, you fold a paper in thirds. One person draws head down to the neck. Without looking, someone else draws neck to waist, and another draws the rest. Then the paper is unfolded and you check out whatever Frankenstein body you've created. What you may not know is that you are playing a game devised by artist André Breton in the 1920s at the height of the Surrealist movement. It's just one of the many games the Surrealists played, and you can too at 3S Artspace in Portsmouth this month. Leading the games, Roger Miller. He's founder of the influential punk band Mission of Burma and of the Alloy Orchestra, an experimental ensemble that provides live scores to silent films. Virginia spoke with him about his affection for Surrealist games earlier this year.
Well, we called this game Exquisite Corpse. Other people said that they played Exquisite Corpse with words. Now, where did this all come from?
When the Surrealists started becoming active in the early 20s, one of their main goals was to resolve the previously contradictory conditions of dream and reality. So to that end, they did a lot of games that were designed to bring things together that didn't necessarily fit together correctly, which is how dreams function a lot. A very famous sentence by the patron saint of Surrealism, the Comte de La Tremont, or his real name was Isidore Lucien Ducasse, sums it up. The chance meeting on a dissecting table of a sewing machine and an umbrella. Now that sentence combines three elements that do not belong together. Dissecting table, sewing machine, umbrella. But when you put them together, at least my mind immediately conjures up an image and you start making associations, which the human mind will do. The human mind will create meaning out of these things, and that is very much a dreamlike meaning.
So these Surrealists actually got together, you know, I'm thinking Breton and Magritte, you know, sitting around and playing these kind of crazy disassociative games?
Yes, they did it. If you have any books on Surrealism, you'll see a lot of these Exquisite Corpse drawings, primarily the drawings, because once Surrealism became less of a goal of poetry and more of a visual goal, which is what most of us know it as, then the drawing games became more important. And I've seen them with, you know, Man Ray, Duchamp, Max Ernst, you know, Breton, Tanguy, all my favorite guys, you know, playing together, and some of my favorite gals as well.
So what are some of the other games that Surrealists played?
Well, there's that drawing game, the Exquisite Corpse, and I encourage people to not necessarily treat it just as, you know, a head, a torso, and a leg, but the legs could be a tree, the torso could be, you know, planets in outer space. This increases the dreamlike quality. There's quite a few word games. The very first game that the Surrealists created, which generated the phrase Exquisite Corpse, is that they would take a sentence, break it down to adjective, noun, adverb, verb, adjective, noun. And the first person would write an adjective, fold the paper back. The next person would write a noun, fold the paper back, until you've got the six words and you have a sentence. And the very first sentence that they created this way was, "The Exquisite Corpse shall drink the new wine." And that's where the phrase, the Exquisite Corpse, comes from.
So you're going to be the master of ceremonies for this game playing at 3S Art Space. What is your role in all of this?
I have a PowerPoint that is explaining the games and projecting them on a screen the entire time, but also on the table there are the rules to the various games, and my job is to go around and explain a new game when people want a new game.
So that's so funny to me that Surrealist had rules.
Well, you have to have rules. There's a very famous, one of my favorite I Ching hexagrams is called Limitation, because without some sort of limitation, the world is infinite and it just explodes. You know, you need something to contain a situation. And so these rules contain a situation and then allow that dreamlike activity to happen.
So have you ever been the master of ceremonies with a live group like this before?
Oh, yeah. I've done it at the ICA in Boston, Mass MoCA, Real Art Ways. And I've done it with my friends, you know, not infinite amount of times, but hundreds, let's just say.
So how does it work with a big group?
It's great. What the situation is always set up so that there are many tables, and the ideal amount of people per table is between 3 and 6. And these people get together usually just by chance. It's a nice chance operation from the very beginning. You know, a couple will come, they'll sit in a table, 2 other people will come. I'll say, why don't you sit down over there? And they've never met each other before. And then they start playing the games. What really I find so beautiful about this is that I have come across people and they've been sitting at tables like, oh, you guys must know each other. You know, you guys look like you're friends. And they said, oh no, we just met each other 50 minutes ago.
It's so interesting. I mean, this is something we used to play as kids, right? Mm-hmm. And why do we stop? I love this idea that surrealists continue with this kind of silliness. I mean, it's not something that you don't hear of abstract expressionist games, do you? What did the surrealists mean to you, and why do they play?
I mean, there's something about surrealism that it sometimes gets knocked by some serious artists. They don't take it surrealism as serious as I do. What I like about surrealism is not one thing that's really important about it. It's not a style. It's an attitude. You know, if you look at 2 different surrealist artwork, they look completely different, or the writers. What I find so appealing about these games is that anybody can play. I've had people walk in and say, well, you know, I don't know how to draw. And I go, it doesn't matter. Because if you have 3 people at a table and one person is a great artist and wants to prove they're a great artist, if they draw a head, you know, the upper part of a drawing that's excellently executed, but if it doesn't attach in an intuitive way to the middle part, then the drawing is not important. So it's not about the individual, it's about the collective. And that's what makes these games, to me, so amazing.
How do people respond to you doing this, though? I mean, you still tour with Mission of Burma. This is a band that so many have cited as influential to them. Nirvana, The Pixies, R.E.M., Sonic Youth. So, I don't know, it may be kind of surreal that you host these kind of things, right?
I've had some friends make some funny comments. It's like I'm a psychedelic Dick Cavett. That's one way it was described by some people that are more my age. When I'm doing the Surrealist Games, my job is to be the Surrealist Games host. And if someone wants to talk to me about Mission of Burma, that's fine. But I'm there to be the Surrealist Games host and facilitate everybody to have this experience of, even if they don't think they're creative, that they will create something. And when they open up the paper at the end of the games, the word games or the drawing games, everybody, I guarantee, will be just like, you know, laughing. And sometimes these things are not just funny, they actually have a sense of profundity.
Roger Miller is a founder of the influential punk band Mission of Burma and Alloy Orchestra. He's leading an evening of surrealist games at 3S Artspace in Portsmouth this month. You'll find more information at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And of course, there will be a soundtrack. Here's a sample of some of the artists Roger plans to play. that's just a sample of music chosen by Roger Miller, musician, artist, and MC of an evening of surrealist games at 3S Artspace later this month. For more, visit wordofmouthradio.org. Before the break, we talked about the spillover between a rock and roller and surrealism. Now to a musician and composer whose work has been described as surreal. Hrishikesh Hirway is creator of the podcast Song Exploder, and he delves into Stone Milker, a song from Björk's 2015 album Vulnikura.
It's about someone who's trying to get emotions out of another person. The whole song is emotionally about wanting clarity, wanting simplicity, and talking to someone who wants things to be really complex and foggy and unclear. And you're saying, okay, I've got clarity. So, you know, want it or not. So it's like sort of celebrating simplicity and clarity. I was walking on a beach and I was kind of walking back and forth, and the lyrics kind of came along kind of without me really editing them. The strength of this album really is just simplicity and, you know, this kind of like thinking out loud feeling. And I shouldn't be too clever. It would work against it. So I kind of just went with the first words that actually came.
Moments of clarity are so rare. I better document this.
Probably the most obvious lyrics I've ever written. I actually wrote a whole nother lyric to the song, which was really maybe a bit too clever for its own good. But something in me just said, no, don't touch it. It has to be like almost clumsy or naive. That's sort of the strength and the weakness of the song at the same time.
I wish to synchronize our feelings, our feelings. Ooh, oh, show some emotion.
I'm mostly a singer, but I think the way I sing, I usually wait for a day where I'm kind of probably more impulsive than other days in one way or another. So when I sing, I'll go to this place where it's more similar to when I'm doing a concert. I will not have so much of my brain in there. I'll just like warm up my voice, have a coffee, and I'll just jump in the deep end where you're more a performer. But I think more and more, ever since I got my laptop 15 years ago, probably the biggest part of me as a musician is the editor. I probably spend like 90% of my time making music editing. You know, if it's editing vocals, editing beats, editing instruments, I think that's a very big part of my work now. So that's also another side.
Who can share and who has shut down the chances?
That sentence is there and the reverb is cut there just to show, you know, what happens if you are closed. If you cut down chances, it's a certain closing a door there. And sometimes you show sonically something emotional.
Who has shut down the chances?
The melody is so simple and the words are so simple. I actually waited for the right microphone because it had to be really like that you hear every detail in the voice. So it's like a really high definition human that's there. After I'd written the songs and I was starting working on the beats, I met Alejandro Arca. And it was a magical relationship. And he was obviously so talented. So I decided to take a back step and for it to be a handshake between me and him. We sat next to each other and we talked about every single thing because I'd already written all the songs. With Stone Milker, it was very obvious that that song is very simple, so we didn't really need a crazy beat thing going on. It just had to be really supportive of the song and almost acoustic, like it's a symphony orchestra playing and the beat would come from the kettle drum or something, you know, like just a very soft support, which Alejandro provided. So I would sit down at a keyboard and just work out the chords. And then when I'm ready with the chord structure, because I knew it would be for strings, I would take it to violins, violas, cellos, because I kind of wanted a lot of it to be in the strings. We actually saved it till last, and I did several days of recording the strings. I had 30 players, and then I would do two sets of arrangements, so basically they are in theory 60, because it needed that sort of panoramic feeling to have that sort of smooth, cream-like perfection. For me, it was very important with Stone Milker that the strings were kind of cyclical, this chord cycle that kind of gives you this feeling it can go on in circles and gives you this feeling of equilibrium, like the person who's singing the song is showing some sort of harmony to someone as an example. I layered several recordings of the strings to be like a tower of equilibrium that you are standing in, like a monument of equilibrium. And you're standing in the middle of it and you're small and it's huge and it just goes circle and circle and you feel very safe and secure. And that's sort of the clarity that I would want to offer, try to offer emotionally in the song. And the strings are kind of the tool I have to try to make this kind of cradle. So I spent a lot of time going through all the takes and all the mics and try to make this kind of tight woven net that each string instrument was equally important because they have all these kind of sub-melodies that they would, you could hear them all, but it would still not be a solo, that it was like this balance of this kind of woven string tower that was keeping you safe. Because there was so much work and so much about the textures in the strings that I thought it deserved a version where the beats are not shadowing the string textures, that there was another version would exist and that I would get not just the strings functioning as a whole, but also have solo violins to do more and to kind of indulge more in the microphone textures. Also, I think it's a question of, like, tempo. Like, I feel the main version of Willni Kura has more drive. You know, the beats obviously give it more energy. But I felt there was another version of Willni Kura with just the strings where it's more slower pace, you know, more like you reading a book at home, you know, like lying outside in the moss looking at the sky. I think Stone Milker, it's a one big question, really. You're asking someone a question, suggesting something, but you don't want to push too hard, trying to, in a very in the most harmonious way possible, trying to prove a point. So it's sort of a very gentle suggestion, because I think staying emotionally open, it's a choice, you know? I think it's equally hard for all of us, and we're just all doing our best, but I think there's also a choice, you know? Do you want to try and then maybe fail half of the time and then succeed half of the time or whatever your odds are? Or is it your choice to not even try?
And now, here's Stone Milker by Björk.
That conversation was brought to us by Hrishikesh Hirway, creator and host of the podcast Song Exploder. You'll find more episodes at songexploder.net. Thanks for listening today. There's much more to hear at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And don't forget, you can listen to the show anytime on the Word of Mouth podcast, which you can find by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or wherever you download your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, do us a favor and rate it on iTunes. Like everybody says, it really does help. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.